This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name is Jacinta Parsons and I'm from the ABC. And it is such an enormous pleasure to welcome you here to the Wheeler Centre to another instalment of the Hey Girl series that's been happening this week. And I'm pretty excited that I'm here for this one, as you are, a trans teen story. And tonight we're going to take a dive into the experience of one of our panellists, Georgie Stone, and her journey as a transgender girl who's had to take on a number of fights throughout her life to be accepted and supported simply for who she is. She's one person telling her story, but it's a story that reaches us all and connects significantly with so many people. It's a story that has already had the power to change laws and consequently the treatment of other young people who identify as transgender. What incredible amount of courage it takes to stand up wherever you find yourself in life for who you are. And when the odds are stacked against you and deep societal conventions make the being of who you are very, very difficult and at times dangerous, it is resoundingly inspiring to see the act of being oneself performed with such courage and compassion. The issues that are faced by transgender people in our country and in this city are deeply concerning. Young transgender people experience verbal and physical abuse because of their gender identities, and studies have shown that this abuse leads to high levels of depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts. As UK writer and transgender woman Juliet Jacques shared in her recent memoir, it is not really a question of about the wrong body, but the wrong society. It's an enormous pleasure, as I said, to be here this evening to host this discussion. We'll be talking for some time, and then we're going to open it up to all of you to ask those burning questions and to listen and learn from our esteemed panel. And joining us to share some of his many years working with young people who are experiencing gender dysphoria, and as one of the people involved in the establishment of the original Royal Children's Hospital Gender Service, is Associate Professor Campbell Paul, a child and adolescent psychiatrist who's been working at... He's not a child. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist who's been working... We'll find out, actually. The jury's still out. Working at the Royal Children's Hospital for just over 36 years. He's an associate professor in psychiatry at Melbourne University and more recently a consultant infant psychiatrist at the Women's Hospital. I think I got all that right. We are grateful for your contribution tonight. Let's whoop it up. We warmly welcome Rebecca Robertson, who founded Transcend in 2012, the first peer-led nationwide support network for transgender children and their families, and has been part of advocating for transgender teens since 2007. She's been at the forefront of challenging and changing laws and in a landmark court case that now enables access to medical support possible for many more transgender children. And she continues to fight, and we'll hear more about that tonight. Please welcome Rebecca Robertson. See, the whoop is becoming very natural. Rebecca is the mother of the star of our show this evening. She's a 16-year-old passionate and dedicated advocate for young transgender people, and along with her mother Rebecca, fought that landmark case called ReJamie to ensure that children were able to access puberty-blocking medications without costly court interventions, and thereby, as we said, ensuring a safer and more inclusive world for other transgender people under the age of 18. And it's the place that we're going to start tonight. She's here with you. Please make her feel super, super welcome. It's Georgie Stone. I feel like we're on a panel. We're going to get to some of the issues about trans teens facing in regards to accessing much-needed stage 2 medication especially, but we'll get to that soon. It's been an incredible journey for you. I'm going to switch around here. Whoops. You are fast becoming a prominent voice for the transgender and wider LGBTIQ community. How are you finding this sort of new role that you found yourself in?
Well, it's a role I never expected myself to be in, but I'm loving advocating, especially with my mum. It's been a great feeling being able to do events like this, being on Australian Story. It's just fantastic to be able to share my story and have people react to it and learn something from it. And it's exciting. I never thought that I'd be doing this, but I am, and I'm loving it.
Well, we're loving that you're doing it too. Let's go back to the very beginning, because there are definitely people with us tonight who have just started on this journey as well. How old do you think you were when you knew that you were a girl?
I was 2.5.
There is a time.
Yeah, I remember exactly. I don't fully remember exactly when I said it, but I know I was 2.5 and I told my mum, "Mum, I want a vagina." I was very upfront, and
there's no clearer way to say it, is there?
Yeah, she knew straight away. And sorry, I just said, "Mum, I want a vagina," when I was 2.5, and yeah, she was like, "Wow, yeah, you can."
Well, it's not a conversation you expect to have at bath time, with who you assumed was your son. So I just went, "But you're a lovely boy," and moved on. So it was a bit of a, "What's that?" But I wasn't frightened of anything happening. I wasn't concerned in any way, shape or form. So it actually took many years after that to really absorb the importance of what Georgie had been telling me for a number of years.
It almost needs to be a book, doesn't it? Because that sentence in itself and that statement is really clear. But as the kind of the years go on, was it difficult for you as a young person to actually have the language to explain the experience to the world outside of you?
Oh, definitely. At first I didn't understand what was happening. I knew it wasn't normal, but I didn't know how to put my finger up when I was younger, before primary school. I was like, "Well, I know I'm a boy and I'm friends with lots of other boys, but I like dress-ups and I like princesses." And I knew that that wasn't usual. So I was definitely confused when I was younger, before primary school.
And for you too, Rebecca, you've spoken about other parents in the days when Georgie was at school and going through early transition, kind of pointing the finger at you and saying, "Well, this is obviously something that you've created in terms of behaviour because of your needs for her to be a daughter." Mm. Did you internalise any of that as well in terms of feeling a responsibility for what was happening?
Almost definitely. For me, and I think it's a common experience, you're often so discombobulated by what your child is telling you, that you're listening and trying to stay calm and not reacting. So when other people outside your family bubble react quite strongly or aggressively about it, it can be incredibly shocking, not least of which because it's actually none of their business.
Say that again. It's actually
none of their business. And what you're going through is really very intense. So, of course, you're approaching everything around this with incredible caution. And we went very slowly along this road. I mean, from the outside, people would say, "Oh my God, transitioned when she was 9, went to the doctors when she was 7, that's too early." But this had been going on since she was 2.5. In many ways, for Georgie, it had been too long coming. And so I think people who are ready to judge perhaps should just sit back and not speak and wait until things unfold a little further, or find out some information from reliable sources.
We also hear for people in families about a mourning potentially or a loss of the son, perhaps. And Harry in Australian Story put it really lovely in the way that he sort of felt like maybe he'd lost a brother, but in fact the whole time he'd had a sister. Did you go through a process of grieving or transition in your own way?
I don't feel that I did. And I think for me, I was so with Georgie every step of the way, listening very closely to what she was saying to me. And we talked every day in some way, shape or form about her experience of herself. And before she transitioned, it was pretty much her primary topic of conversation. So I couldn't escape that. So for me, it was there's a continuity there that Georgie has always been Georgie, and I never had children to have one sex or the other sex. And when I was having twins, I had an opportunity to find out what sex they were, and I didn't. I didn't do the nursery colour scheming because I'm incredibly lazy. And so none of those things mattered to me. It didn't matter. I thought I had two boys and I was as proud as punch of them. But when it was discovered that Georgie was actually a girl, I was still as proud as punch of her. The only thing that I grieve about, and the grief is less now than it used to be, but I grieved for a simpler life for her. And I grieved for the challenges I imagined that she would have to face. And I grieved for the ignorance that she would have to come up against. But grieving for a son that I had and I no longer have, I don't feel loss. There's no loss there because there she is, same person, and just as lovely as ever.
Professor Campbell, your relationship with the transgender community begins almost the same time that Georgie Stone is born, about 15, 16 years ago, when you set up the Gender Services Department at the Children's Hospital. What was the gender landscape like back then? And, I mean, obviously you've seen this over a period very, very closely. How would you describe what we're experiencing and what's happened over that time?
Well, a lot's happened over that time. It's transformed in many ways. In fact, I've been aware of the things around gender and very young children before that through some of the work in infant mental health where people had been interested in when do kids start to become aware of their gender, and at a number of conferences that had been presented. So it was there in my mind and in the some of the professional contacts I had, but certainly meeting Georgie and before that being involved in the role of the family court really threw me heavily into the area when Justice Nicholson decided that around a particular young person it was important, he thought, for the court to support the young people in moving towards having hormone treatment. I don't think there was a realisation of the consequences of that legal intervention.
What was the original concept around the support rather than obstruction?
Well, it was in the context of a young person whose parents weren't able to provide consent for a medical treatment, and the people approached the family court to see if they could act in loco parentis, as it were. And Justice Nicholson was very supportive of the young person having the treatment, but unfortunately, in making the judgment, it meant that it applied to other people where their parents, and they were quite able to understand and give consent for treatment. So people got caught up inadvertently in something that's caused quite a lot of difficulty subsequently.
We're going to get into that a little bit later. Yeah. I'm going to ask you either the most simple or the most complex question. You tell me. Buzz in. What is gender, and why is it so important to us?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Is it? Oh, thank God. Nervous. What do you think?
Intriguing concept and phenomenon. On the surface of it, it looks sort of straightforward, black and white. Again, on the surface of it, people have, through the millennia, seen male and female and as if there's some binary. In fact, it's not binary, and for millennia it's been very non-binary, and it's a phenomenon that's got a biological component, it's got a social, cultural, and at the essence of it, though, is the internal experience of who a person is. I think that's the essence of gender, who you feel you are at the core. And as a lot of, a number of young people have said when others have said, well, how could you know you're a boy or a girl when you're two or three, for kids who are gender questioning, the response to that is, well, most people never question it when they're two or three. So for a young person who says, I'm a girl, there's plenty of experience from the broad bulk of the community to say, well, that's quite a valid genuine statement about who you are and who you feel inside.
Getting the medical community involved, the broader medical community involved in such sort of concepts, are we getting a shift in terms of understanding gender in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think, George's presentation to the broad community has had a significant impact on the medical community as well. Being able to share a person's actual experiences make a big difference. It's not an academic, medical, something out there thing for people to understand, for doctors to understand. It's something deeply personal with the families who they see, and for themselves as well.
Georgie, one of the most disturbing features of your story, from sitting outside it, and it reflects, it seems, so many transgender stories, includes some really painful experiences of bullying that happened early on and abuse. How early did that start for you?
That started around the age of eight, quite intensely, around the age of eight.
Was there something at that time for you that happened, or...?
I slowly started transitioning. So I was slowly growing my hair longer. I tried to make the uniform more feminine, although I wasn't allowed to wear the female uniform. Or I was conscious that I would get quite bullied if I did. I started hanging out with girls as well. And people saw that. Especially there are a few boys a few years above me, and they really had a problem with it. They'd come up to me saying, are you a boy or a girl? They said, you can't be a girl, you're actually a boy. This isn't right, you're weird. And it was awful. It was really hard to take, especially for an eight-year-old. So I think at that point it was very important. I was seeing Campbell Paul at that point, so he really helped. Mum really helped. But, yeah, it was...
What really helped? Because I think this is those sort of things for people going through this stuff. It is one of the most challenging things you go through in mm-hmm. some ways. What were some of the things that helped you get through your daily life?
People like Campbell Paul and my mum telling me the opposite, that I wasn't weird, that I am a girl, and that or whatever I choose, whoever I am, it's okay. And I'm not weird, I'm not a freak, I'm a person. And that was fantastic. That really helped. My brother as well supporting me was made a big difference. My friend supporting me, just having a support group around you really makes a world of difference. That's why it's really tragic when trans people or LGBT people are alone. They don't have anyone there to support them. That's when it becomes really dangerous.
Rebecca, how would you articulate the misunderstanding that the school had around Georgie?
Look, I think it was a sign of the times as much as anything else. And the landscape for families like ours has changed a lot in those years since 2007 when I first raised it with the school. At that point in time, there was no government schools policy to support trans or intersex students at school, and there was no Safe Schools Coalition. So really, you were going into bat for your own kid in schools that really had never had a single experience of this before. So that's in defence of them, but they were not willing to listen to what we had to say. And we got letters of support from Campbell to try and explain the situation and say, yes, it is appropriate that you provide the female bathroom to Georgie and so on and so forth. But that wasn't forthcoming, and they weren't helpful to me in protecting Georgie in certain situations. Like, every parent of a trans kid knows how terrible swimming lessons are for trans kids. And that was where we came unstuck finally, wasn't it, Dahl?
Yeah. The big bullying experience for me was when I was 9. It was school swimming. I had to use the male change rooms. And by that point, I was 9. I was wearing quite feminine bathers, and having to use the male change rooms was hell. It was hell. There were people screaming at me inside, boys saying, "What are you doing in here?" You know, and I shouldn't have been in there. And it was one of the worst experiences of my life. And really, with the bullying I've actually had it good. There are some kids who are incredibly harassed every day, and it's awful. And yeah, I think school swimming is definitely a massive problem for trans kids who haven't transitioned yet. If their school isn't supportive, if they don't have the Safe Schools Coalition, it's awful.
And how gendered do you think schools are? I mean, sitting from a position where you've really had to experience it this way.
Well, really, Georgie was quite happy with herself until she went to school. She could dress up at home, whatever she wanted. You know, she wore traditionally male-oriented clothes when we went out. But at that point in time, it wasn't as much of an issue for her. But when we went to school, it was suddenly totally gendered, and Georgie was shoved in with the boys all the time. It was just, it was really difficult for you to cope with that sort of...
Yeah, I don't know why they do this, but in primary school and sport, there was a boys' line and a girls' line. I don't really know what the point of that was, but lining up to go to class, there was a boys' line and a girls' line. I think that's pointless, really.
It's things that we are so constructed to do that it takes sometimes, you know, a little wake up to ask those questions. Mm. Why are we doing this?
Mm. Yeah.
And it takes that view. Campbell, what, from your perspective as a psychiatrist, what drives this bullying and abuse in this instance? What is the fear? Where is it coming from? Why is there such hostility?
Well, I think there's a whole heap of ignorance. Young people don't understand. I'm sure there are young people who feel challenged as well. There's uncertainty about their own identity, and because kids are trying to form their own identity, especially as puberty comes on in the later stages of primary school, kids are really preoccupied about groups, identity and belonging and not belonging, and if it feels like someone is challenging their sense of safety or security, though you weren't, but from their perspective, then it can get quite intense for some kids who are uncertain about who they are and what they should be doing and how their relationships work. So it opens up a sort of a line of distress amongst themselves, which is comes out as this projected anger and the bullying. Yeah.
And it does, I guess. So no, go, Rebecca.
I just wanted to say that in the swimming incident at school, the kids in Georgie's class in that male bathroom were actually fine because they'd always known Georgie. Georgie had always been Georgie. They knew her situation, but it was because that she'd been forced to go in with older boys who didn't know her situation. And that was something, again, that the school had not allowed me to have control over as a mother. It was a public toilet as well. And so there was actually no control over his situation. But the kids in her class had always been pretty supportive of
mostly,
you, hadn't they?
Yeah.
And when she finally transitioned at school, apparently some of the mums came up to me the next day and said, Benji came up to me last night and said, Georgie's a girl. We already knew that.
Yeah. In terms of that that vulnerable stage in that transition, is there a particular time that you are more vulnerable than others when you're making that transition? Did you find that, and Campbell as well, from a professional perspective?
I don't know if there's a specific time within transition. I think transition just in and of itself is really hard. I'd been at that school since I was six. At that point, I had short hair. I was George. And then transitioning in school, when they'd seen me before, that was very difficult because I'd got a lot of questions, even from my year level when they were supportive. They were just confused. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really hard. And even just weird looks, that it was really difficult. Just, I think it was about a year overall of transition, which was difficult. But, I mean, every trans person's experience is different.
And I guess it depends on at what point they transition to.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons why we're such supporters of the Safe Schools Coalition is that we've experienced life without them. And I think when you have trained professionals who can go into a school and train teachers and so on, and to help the kids be able to understand and to help the kids learn to empathise with somebody who is going through something quite different from their own experiences, it's a really positive thing, and I don't think that Georgie would have had those experiences had the school been more open to a wider discussion. And I did say at the time, this could be an opportunity for your students to learn about difference and accepting difference. And it was just too much for them to bite off at the time because there wasn't any support for them either. So I think that's why Safe Schools is just so needed and so loved by the families who have had support from them.
Yeah, and I think for the young people themselves, having the knowledge that Safe Schools can go in and explain to the broad school community what the situation is makes a huge difference. The concept in the kids' mind then can be, oh, people might understand. I don't have to explain to everyone. It is possible to transition and be understood and accepted before that, if there's an awareness that, or an expectation that many of the parents, the other kids, will be confused or hostile, or then it makes the whole business of becoming who you are so much more difficult. And it's amazing, I think, how supportive people can be when they're informed, when they're aware.
Mm-hmm.
One young family, a kid, an eight-year-old, with in what they thought was a very conservative primary school, the parents thought, we're never going to be able to do this here. They saw how distressed their child was. They spoke to Safe Schools. Safe Schools go in and spoke to the school. The following week, there was a young person transitioned. The next day, there were loads of emails from other parents and casseroles on the front doorstep. So people shouldn't underestimate the impact of that awareness in a community like that.
Mm. Did you get casseroles, Rebecca?
No.
Still time, people.
You're the
I didn't. I'm surprised I didn't get bunnies in pots, actually, from some of the... Look, some of the mums gave me.
I was going to ask you about that too. It's not only the children that sort of face that discrimination as well. It's parents too, isn't it, that are having to face other parents who simply do not understand. We see before us Georgie Stone, who knew from 2 years old who she was. Campbell, do you have, do most patients, patients is the wrong word, people that present to you, are they that sure always?
No, it's very it's a very complex process, I think. Most kids who experience the follow a transgender pathway before kinder are comfortable and able to talk about things or are thinking about their own identity. But as George was saying, the process of going into school where things become very binary in terms of boys and girls is really a big cognitive hurdle to overcome. I think young people are sort of busy trying to work out who they are from the beginning. Even at two and three, they'll look in the mirror and they say, well, you know, I've got this body, but I feel this way. How does that work? And in a supportive family, kids are able to continue to explore that and work out who they are. But when you get to school, there's this big split, and you have to be one or the other. And I think that's a huge pressure for young people. But if we can help kids explore that as they go, then it makes a big difference. But some people are struggling with it throughout childhood and adolescence and early adulthood. At the adult service in Melbourne at Monash, the average age for people coming to the clinic is around 40, and almost all the people say, well, that was what I was feeling when I was at kinder and at preschool. So people struggle with it for a long time.
And the struggle you're articulating becomes because of that social intersection with how you're feeling, but then how you are asked to project in society.
But also how you try and unravel that conundrum within yourself. And I think through Georgie's family, she was able to think, oh, hang on, I look in the mirror and that's me, but I don't feel that way. How am I going to reconcile that? And having a loving, supportive family beside you as you work through that makes a... obviously a world of difference, a huge difference. And some kids can't get to the point of saying at 2.5 I want a vagina. It's already become a conundrum that's locked inside, and I guess families' role, our role, is to help people
language it.
Or in play, if you include play as part of language, that's a critical bit. Drawings, there's ways of sharing it with people and sharing it with yourself.
This is almost just the beginning of the story of what we've covered thus far. One of the big parts of the story too for you, you were one of the youngest people of all time in Australia at the age of 10 to be given permission to use puberty-blocking hormones. Tell us a little bit about what puberty-blocking hormone treatment is.
Well, puberty blockers are hormones that suppress puberty. For me, it's an injection. So originally we had to apply to the Family Court of Australia to access this treatment. And as Mum can explain it better, it was a very stressful time for us as a family.
And you were 10 when the process started? How old?
I just turned 10. Uh-huh. And it took quite a number of months. So when I finally got access to puberty blockers, I was 10 years and 9 months, was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And for the family and for the experience for you to make that decision to use puberty blockers, was there any question?
Oh, I don't think by that stage there was. I mean, possibly in the years leading up, is this what we're going to be faced with? But Georgie's puberty was early and very precocious, so it was quite forceful. And we'd just been ambling along for a few years, really. We were
getting into the groove.
Quite a nice hiatus, you know, as far as stress was concerned.
The year before, I had fully transitioned. I moved school, so I was fully out as female in the public and within my family. So at that point, we were very comfortable.
Mm. So at that point in time, Professor Gary Warne was looking after Georgie as her endocrinologist. And so they do fairly regular testing. And I actually said to Gary that Greg and I were both early bloomers and maybe keep a bit of an extra eye out. And so things were starting to move along that way. And then we had started pulling our legal papers together and had just filed them, I think, and had gone for a regular checkup with Gary. And Gary examined Georgie and said, what is your lawyer's number? We need to call them now and get this seen to urgently. So she had gone from, I don't know, I think probably a Tanner stage 2, which is, you know, fairly early in puberty, to Tanner stage 4, which is at that point was the pubertal level of a 14-year-old.
Wow.
When she was 10. So we had to really move and fast, because Georgie was in danger of losing the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity of not having her voice break. And that would have... Georgie had always begged for that not to happen, and if we had missed that point, it would have been very difficult. So the court system is very slow, and biology is very fast. Very costly, although I did a big ring around and trying to find lawyers who would work for us pro bono, because we barely had 2 farthings to rub together at that point in time. And I was working as a massage therapist. I trained as a massage therapist in 2007, and I had this two lovely clients, a husband and wife, and one worked at the new school that Georgie was going to, and the other was a barrister. And yes. So that it was so excellent, because she had said, oh, you're having trouble at your old school, come to ours, it's great. And she was right. And then I rang her husband and said, do you know any lawyers who specialise in family law? And so he rang around and he hooked us up with these fantastic people. And they work for us pro bono, but it's still an expensive process. And
so yeah. You appealed to the court, and we're going to whoop again in a minute, because you made a huge change to the landscape in this way of ensuring that future families would be able to bypass that process.
Yes, that Well, we were aiming to get rid of both stages.
So there's stage one puberty blockers
stage
and stage
one
two?
Is the cross-sex hormones or gender-affirming hormones. So the first court case, Georgie was granted permission to take puberty blockers but not the stage two cross-sex hormones. So we appealed on that basis, and the basis that it's not a special medical procedure. I won't go into all of this. You'll be snoring in 2 seconds, but it's quite complicated. And we were able to do that simply because our lawyers were working for us pro bono, and they really, really believed in making this change. It was so fundamentally unfair. So we had the opportunity. They gave us the opportunity and the means, and the judge gave us the opportunity by ruling against us, and we took it because we didn't know who or when there would be another opportunity to take that. Those opportunities don't come around very often. So we appealed before the full bench of the family court. Quite a year of going to court. It's a lot of in and out of court, really. Directional hearings, interveners, all kinds of stuff. It's actually mind-boggling. And
at a fundamental level as well, it's a big question, isn't it, to who you are. You know, that if you're going in and out of court, having to argue your case to be allowed to be who you are is deeply difficult.
Yeah. Look, I actually can't talk about the details of the case because it's still all suppressed until Georgie's 18. But I can say it's really, really difficult to sit in a courtroom and listen to people who have never met your children or your child or your family have opinions that are barely based, in fact, about whether your child should have treatment or not. I found that to be the very definition of powerlessness. It was really an awful experience, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
Well, you have saved a lot of families from going through that
same experience,
stage one, and let's whoop that, shall we?
Congratulations.
And significant and vital for all the reasons that you just articulate. But, of course, there's still the stage two that you still need to get access from the courts for, stage two cross-sex hormone change.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are the feelings around why that was not granted in that way? What are your thoughts?
Look, I just don't think they were willing to take that step. I don't know if it would be wrong for me to publicly speculate on that because they deliberated for 18 months. We didn't get a decision on that for 18 months. My feeling is that they've lived to regret that because of the problems that it's caused. They had a really good opportunity to change it then, and they didn't. I think there was a level of conservatism there. We are stuck with the repercussions of them failing to be bold in that situation. That's what I think.
And those repercussions are now for families who are wanting to access cross-sex hormone treatment are quite extensive, aren't they? You need to be able to have enough finances to be able to go to court to apply for this stuff. What are some other things that are really difficult for this?
Well, I think access too. I mean, there are plenty of people in regional Australia that need this treatment and find it difficult to access legal support pro bono. In the cities, it's a little bit easier to access that pro bono legal support. Time, travel, money, For example, Greg and I are both contract workers. Between us, we lost about $30,000 to $40,000 going to court just from having to turn down work and be available.
There's quite a few kids who don't want to stress their parents, yeah. either. They say, oh, you know, I don't want to have to go to court, and it'll just cause whole dramas in the family, and I don't want to put my parents through that.
And some families make a decision between whether they're going to go to court to get gender-affirming hormones or whether they're going to save their money for intervention once the young person's 18. Mm. So really it's forcing people or preventing people from accessing the treatment that is appropriate for them and is their right.
We've got not as much time as we want. I want to keep talking forever. We're going to be throwing it over to the audience in a moment for questions. Campbell, I just wanted to quickly ask you, too, you touched on it before regarding families. We see a beautiful, loving family here that worked together, that worked with their communities to advocate for Georgie. I would imagine that not every family has that same kind of setup. What is the situation for children who don't have family advocates working for them? What are their options and how are you able to support children in that way?
Well, we certainly have had a small number of young people who've come to the service on their own bat, sometimes without the knowledge or with knowledge but without the permission of their parents. And like other aspects of health, trying an understanding of the young person's understanding of what the problem is and what they need, and age in itself is not a barrier to accessing the service and the clinic and aspects of the pre-court hormone treatment. And I think that's an important facility for young people to have. They shouldn't feel excluded from an opportunity to talk about and explore who they are and get appropriate treatment if there's a conflict with their parents as the main impediment. But we would always try and work with the parents, and that would be one of the things we'd, you know, talk with the young person about. Maybe that your folks would be supportive and interested and curious, but there's certainly been young people where they felt that wouldn't work, and we still work with them and see what we can do to support and help them on their journey. I guess the other problem is there's presumably lots of families and young people who don't get to the point of making contact, and maybe they're the people who at a later age in adulthood, when in control of their own lives more, are able to go to an adult service and talk about it. So there's a lot of, I suspect, a lot of young people who we don't see. When in New Zealand they did a large online anonymous survey of secondary school students, and about 2,000 or 3,000 young people, and asked them about how they experienced their gender. I think there was something like 1.5% of those kids said that they identified as transgender. Another 2% weren't sure and were in the more maybe gender exploring situation. But it's obviously something that's not rare. It's not, but lots of young people, I think, find it really hard to
make that first step.
Yeah, make the first step.
Well, hey, girl, this is what this week is. Looking at you sitting here, it feels like such a wonderful celebration of a really big journey that you've been on. But there's a lot more to come. How does the world look to you through your hey girl eyes? Did I seem cool then? Like Nana talking to you?
There are so many things that could happen, so many opportunities. I'm really thankful and grateful to be able to have this opportunity to be here. I really want to do more of this. There's just, I really, an objective for both, for all three of us, is really to change the law surrounding stage two treatment, cross-sex hormones. I've started a petition on change.org, and we really want to get up to 5,000 signatures and present that to the Parliament of Australia, because we need to change this law. It's really affecting lives and we need to get it out of the courts. So that's a big thing for us at the moment. That's one thing.
I think that sounds like a pretty big, amazing, wonderful thing.
Yeah, and also just want to say it's not just us. There are so many families and young people who are trying to make a difference in their community, who are educating people, who are telling their stories. And I think it's really good. 10 years ago, this wasn't happening. So it's really good for lots of people to be telling their stories and standing up and speaking out. So I think that is a great improvement and a great development in our world today.
Yep. Yeah. I think that deserves a whoop as we open up the floor for some questions. Yeah. Okay, first question.
Hi.
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 Oh, God. Wait a second. Yes. Okay. Sorry. So, as you were saying before with gender, these days we're just starting to talk about trans issues, and we're mostly talking about more binary trans people. But as you said, gender is pretty non-binary and stuff like that. I wanted to ask anyone on the panel, what's the look of the landscape so far as medical treatment for non-binary Australians? Because I know a lot of my my fellow non-binary friends, when they tried to get HRT, they found that they had to lie. In order to, even once they were 18 or above, they had to lie in order to kind of fit the narrative that a lot of doctors were expecting them to have as trans people who wanted to access HRT. So do you think that's starting to change? And,
Campbell, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it is starting to change. Access to hormone treatment for non-binary young people is certainly becoming more common and available. I guess as a profession, the medical profession is generally moderately fairly conservative, but I've seen significant shift there over the last few years. I guess what people are trying to do in those sort of consultations with young people is to make sure that they do no harm, because we know we've got the capacity for making things worse as well as making things better sometimes. So we would be really working with young people to try and understand as best we can what's going to be most helpful in a way that opens options rather than closes options down.
Thank you. That was a great question. Next question.
Hello. So I just wanted to ask, in your opinion, did the court treat you respectfully?
No, I don't know. I don't think there's any way that it could be respectful. This shouldn't be in the courts at all in the first place. It is damaging to families. And I was actually not aware. I was really young. I was 10 when it first started. I wasn't aware of what was happening, but I knew that it was hurtful and I saw my body changing before my eyes. And it was scary. And it was scary for my mum. It was scary for my family. And it's not respectful and it's not nice to go through.
I just had a couple of questions. I hear a lot of people say, oh, I think she's too young to understand, like what you were saying, but what is the difference between a kid who is just playing dress-ups, for want of a better word, and a kid who actually does want to change gender? Because, like, it might be really hard to tell when they're 2, 3, 4, that sort of age.
And I think that reflects a really large thinking in our community. Georgie, for you first, what would be your answer to that in terms of knowing?
Well, for me, I can't speak for my mum, but for me, I knew that I was a girl. I didn't want to be a girl. I am a girl. And it's not just, I mean, I liked playing dress-ups, obviously, but it's who I wanted to be, not what I wanted to experience. It's, for me, this sounds very intense, but it's life or death, and it's life or death for a lot of people. If I couldn't be who I was, I would have committed suicide because I can't live my life not being who I am. And that is the same for all trans people. For someone who is just experimenting, which is completely understandable and fine and natural, it's not life and death. But for me and for trans people everywhere, it is. But mum's perspective is...
Yeah, so, I mean, that's... my thoughts when Georgie first told me at 2.5, and as the years went by, her dad and I thought, well, this might just be a phase. That's fine. It wasn't a big issue either way, but there was a really different intensity to the way that she played and a really different language that she used. It wasn't... I feel like a girl. It was I am a girl, and it was persistent, insistent, and consistent. Her idea of her experience of herself never wavered. I would say that she has never identified as male in her whole life, So there was a completely different intensity. So as a parent, though, you want to do what's right. You don't want to, you know, as Campbell said, you don't want to do any harm. We took a long, long time to really work with Georgie and work with the hospital and work between ourselves to find out exactly what was right for Georgie. And Georgie basically had to wait for the rest of us to catch up. That's essentially her experience, I think. And from insisting from such a young age to her transition at 9, there was an awful lot of soul searching and finding the best information available at that time from around the world to work out what the best way to proceed is. But there's a totally different intensity to it. So my son's kind of play and imaginative play, and when he dressed up, it was just gone and finished with, but Georgie's continued and was very stable for a long time. So not everyone's as articulate as Georgie, and she was very articulate and remains so to this day, able to express herself very well. But there is certainly... it's more intense, I think, than just the normal playfulness of a child experimenting with gender roles and all of that sort of stuff.
Thank you very much. Another question for
Can
us.
Can I just add to,
yeah, please
to that
do.
One? We're talking about the world not being presented in absolute terms and binary male and female. And I think with young children, our job is to help them explore who they are in a non-binary sort of way too. We shouldn't expect kids to have to declare themselves one place or another, male or female. They should be able to, in a supportive and containing sort of family context and social context, be able to explore that and not feel they have to make they don't have to make a firm declaration, even though a good number of young people do.
And even, you know, with stuff that Georgie's saying tonight and other people in the audience, we have to really be aware of our binary prejudice, don't we? That we have really been brought up into a culture that is so marked in this way that we carry it all ourselves, and to be aware of it helps us facilitate a completely different world, hopefully. We probably have time for maybe one more question. Anyone in the audience?
Yeah, thank you. I'd just like to first thank both Rebecca and Georgie for standing up and being vocal and visible in the community. I'm sure this helps the transgender community enormously. And congratulations to you both on your fine work. One thing that really struck a chord with me was Rebecca's description of the court process as being talking about something other than their family. I think Rebecca may have been in this situation a couple of weeks ago where the State Parliament debated the change to the birth certificate legislation. I was there. It had exactly that effect on me. There are a whole lot of coalition members of the Legislative Assembly speaking about transgender people, clearly with no experience of them, not a skerrick of experience of them. And in fact, I know that the coalition in Victoria rejected a briefing from Transgender Victoria on the very bill. Would the change in the birth certificate have mattered? Would it have helped you deal with Georgie's school, for example? Would it help in other ways?
It really would have helped a lot, and also been a really meaningful reflection of who she is. It would have... you go for it, darling.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, so to have a birth certificate available with the right markers on would have made a profound difference to her experiences. At the moment, case in point, Georgie's just applying for her learner's licence. All sorts of things wrong with that. But the worst one is taking her documentation along to the appointment. Now, thankfully, a few years ago, Kevin Rudd made it available, passports available to have the marker correct for you. So we can take that along. But, you know, it's a different process for my son than it is for my daughter. And that's not right. That's not fair. So it would make a huge material difference to have a birth certificate that properly reflects Georgie's identity.
Georgie, did you want to say something?
We've run out of time.
It's flashing red, but let's break some rules, shall we? Say something, Georgie.
Okay. Something, when I was younger, going to the hospital, my name would be called out, George, and on the certificate it would say male. There was always something we'd have to explain every single time. Well, Georgie is transgender, and on every single time. And it was awful, and I hated doing it, going through that, having to explain myself. It was awful. And so, good, next week I can just bring my passport and it's not a big deal, because it really shouldn't be a big deal. And it was always a big deal before. And that's why it's so important we can change the law on that front as well, to be able to have...
Proper birth certificate.
Good. I'm really glad.
See what I mean about the driving thing?
Mum, the thing is flashing red down here, which does mean that it's time for us to end this discussion. It's such a shame, because I feel like there's so much wonderful stuff out here in the audience tonight that would have been wonderful. But this conversation and this discussion is not going to end, and it will continue, and there'll be loud voices like Georgie Stone who stand up and say it loudly from the rooftops, and we will join her and you all. And I want to put our hands together now to thank our wonderful panel, Professor Campbell Paul, Rebecca Robertson, and really loud, Georgie Stone.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.